This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening, all. The first thing to say is that we're gathered this evening on the lands of the Kulin Nation and pay our respects, I'm sure, from all on the panel to their elders past and present and the other community members who may be with us this evening. We're here to talk about publishing. In 2016, adapt or survive is the nominal topic. My name's Jonathan Green. I'm an ABC person and I edit Meanjin, the literary quarterly. Done some other editing things in my time. Across over there, Sam Cooney, he's a writer and publisher. He's the editorial director of Lifted Brow. Next to Sam is Jane Howard, director of the Digital Writers Festival, a contributing editor at Kill Your Darlings, and Steph Harmon beside me here was the founding and managing editor of Junkie, is now recovered from that, as culture editor for Guardian Australia. And we all, four of us, have some contact with publishing in some way, shape or form. I thought I'd begin with a sort of a definitional thing, because it's a funny concept in these times of internets and communities and, you know, the sort of way in which we do stuff these days. What is publishing? It used to be such a pyramidal thing. You'd have a big business that would bring in content and send out staff. Sam, do you have a thought on that? Is it it's a much more elastic idea.
For me, publishing is broadcasting. But what is so different these days is who has access to that manner or mode of broadcasting. So the playing field has been levelled in, as it were, because to broadcast, to publish and to reach a public through publishing used to have to happen through some pretty, a few quite narrow channels, whatever the media of the day was, and now it feels like, it's the case that publishing is now much more non-hierarchical, perhaps, but also just disparate, and that Meanjin or Lifted Brow, The Guardian, or someone, an individual, has the same access to the tools, and even the audience, because, so for me, like, publishing is as simple as it's curatorship and it's all these kinds of things, but it basically is the broadcasting of material, of the content, if we're going to use the C word tonight.
I mean, Jane, it's a funny thing. I mean, and digital is your particular interest at the moment. I mean, it's a space to which everybody has access. So what's the difference between me just putting something up and whatever I have access to and me being bought by someone and having them do it on my behalf?
I started my career in this field, this broad field, as a blogger. I don't have any specific journalistic training outside of, I've done some internships and mentorships since I started writing, but I started entirely in self-publishing online, and it has continued online, and almost everyone that I work for is online. I'm still at that phase when I do get imprint. Like, I was in a Lifted Brow a few issues ago and I owned like 5 or 6 copies of that edition because I was just so excited about being in print. And it's not even that it means, like, the work. I was actually really proud of that piece. I'm proud of that piece, that isn't that issue, but it's not that work is worth more than the stuff that I write for The Guardian or spaces that are online, but there is something beautiful about when someone has invested not only the time in editing you and publishing you, but also paying money to put it in ink on paper. It does feel different, but I don't approach it differently as a writer. It all comes from the same place.
The paper thing is really interesting, Steph. I mean, as someone who works for a purely online organisation, but one with sort of roots in print. I mean, as Jane sort of says, there's a nice idea to being put into that particular medium. It gives you a certain kind of gravitas, maybe, which is a really weird thing in the world that we live in now, that it still has that sort of weight behind it.
And it certainly still does, because the Guardian's a global organisation, but they only print in the UK, and it's still treated as this massive honour if a Guardian Australia article gets chosen for the newspaper. And I'm not sure why, because obviously the potential to reach more people is online. It's not in print, but it still feels like a... I guess because print is limited and you're being selected for a limited publication.
And still, therefore, you know, publishing businesses exist and publishing businesses based in print, despite the fact that it's, I don't know, sort of at odds with the times. I mean, apart from yourself, Jane, I think we're all sort of do print things. Sam, you just started putting out books.
Yeah, well, for us, print is central to what we do because we know what it's like to read online, and we know that there are certain pieces that we know as editors and as publishers, but also as readers first and foremost, that there is something about having a little distraction-free print object in front of you. That is one aspect of it, the idea that perhaps there are pieces that their best vehicle, their best mode of delivery is the print experience, and that is often when people are have the blinkers on, whether it's on the tram or in the couch at home or whatever it is, that they are able to maybe sink in deeper than you would having on a device that is notifying you of things happening every few seconds. But also the other aspect of it for us is the ritual. Like, there's not much of a ritual of popping open a tab and, you know, loading
speak
something.
For yourself.
Yeah. You might light incense and do a little something, but the ritual of holding, and it sounds a bit over the top, but of purchasing or subscribing and then holding and owning and reading a print object, there's something in that still. There is something sacred, is not the word I want to use, but there's something that puts you maybe into a different headspace than clicking that thing that popped up on your feed a second ago and a second ago you didn't know about, and now it's in your face and you're reading it.
I wonder if we're just starting to work out too, I mean, what suits particular media and what's the sort of writing that works best in that sort of form, what's the sort of writing that works best there, because it's despite the fact that we sort of have this constant sense that this is the way things will always be from now on because we've got it sorted now, it's, you know, it's so new, the technology that we're dealing with, our interactions with it are so fresh, the way in which it's going to evolve is so unknown, and we're trying to sort of balance these things out. E-books, 10 years ago, if you said to anybody in publishing, what's the future going to be? Well, it's not going to be in print, it'll be on tablets. And, well, that turned out not to be the case. So, I mean, are we trying to work it out? Do you have thoughts on this, on what works in different places?
I think, like, one of the things that Sam was saying about how we know what it's like to read online, like, one of the things that I'm really excited about, the Digital Writers Festival, so this will be in November, it'll be the third festival, it's my first time running it, is that we don't know what it's like to go to a writer's festival on the internet. And so trying to figure out what that looks like and what technology we can use to modulate that, that's what's really exciting about it to me, is that we know what a writer's festival looks like and we know what it looks like to come to a panel and be involved, but we don't know what it's like when the panel is on a tab and you have other things going on. I think that's an interesting way, even though the internet is so present in our lives, that sort of work isn't present in that space. And so I'm really excited to try and figure out how to engage an audience in that world, in that space.
Why do we have to do that?
Why do we have to do the Digital Writers Festival? Mm. It's run by the Emerging Writers Festival. It's a lot of reasons. It's about just asking those questions of what can we do and what are the possibilities and how can we think about writers' festivals differently. But it's also about access, so we can have people who couldn't come to Melbourne for a writers' festival, yeah, or who are in Melbourne but can't leave their house for any reason. We'll have panels where there'll be people overseas talking to people in Australia on the same panel. And then it's also archived. Like, the Wheeler Centre is really great and they can archive all of their stuff, but not a lot of festivals can archive all of their panels for anyone to watch at any time. And so by putting it on that online space, that exists forever. And I think that's, well, not forever, as long as YouTube lets us stay there.
I mean, I sort of asked that to Stefan, your thoughts on this, because I wonder how much in publishing currently that the technology sort of wags the dog a bit, that we do things in particular platforms because the platforms have been developed and they're there, and we try and sculpt stuff around the needs of the platform rather than perhaps staying true to the text and
idea. I think that's definitely a trap that people fell into, particularly when when we were starting publishing online, people were just trying to use as many tricks as they could, for instance. And you try to embed some audio and you try to embed some video, and then even only just like three or four years ago here, maybe a bit longer ago in the States, we're a bit behind here, but when parallax scroll, which is that fancy scroll you see when you see a long form article online, and the image moves at a different speed to the text, and then the text goes over the image and it looks really pretty, and everyone started doing it, but no one was using it as a proper way to experience an article. People were just using it to show that they could use it. And I think I'd say maybe we're still a few years away from working out exactly what the best way to use technology is to tell stories. I think there's companies and publishers that are doing it really well, but I don't think anyone's completely nailed it yet.
Sam, talk us through your decision at Lifted Brow to start doing books and how that fits into your sort of perception of that business.
Yeah, short answer is that the Australian book industry, the Australian publishing industry, revolves around the book, their printed book as well. And I'm talking about for writers to make a career. Good luck in Australia trying to make a career writing on the online only. Especially the freelancer or somebody who's maybe has disparate interests, but also even our print magazine culture is just small. And in, there's a couple of places that pay well. You've got to work and work and work and work and work to even get in there, let alone get a regular gig. And we see that, unless you're publishing a book or working around books and the printed book, you kind of hit a ceiling, it seems. And so with Lifted Brow, we publish writers that perhaps outside of the mainstream, you know, from the either literary or demographic margins is what we kind of loosely define a lot of our writers as falling under. And we at The Brow were finding ourselves reading more and more in the last few years, reading books that weren't Australian books. So our favourite books were generally American, but books that were interesting, that were crossing, blending genres, and were from the non-hegemonic kind of publishing industry. And I'm talking books like Maggie Nelson's books, Claudia Rankine, Hilton Owls, people who are playing around with form or with voice. And I wasn't seeing, and anyone us at The Brow, we weren't seeing many examples, if any. It's probably one or two in the last few years. Fiona Wright, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You could, off the top of my head, there's probably another couple, but there wasn't that many. And we were all getting concerned about what are these writers in The Brow and others that we're seeing in Australia who are writing in these forms and are pushing boundaries, perhaps, or are being political in a way that's, you know, in your face, or are they going to hit a wall with our industry because of the commercial nature of the industry and most publishers needing to either make a certain amount of money on books, but also not wanting to take risks, and far easier to buy Maggie Nelson's book and publish it here rather than perhaps take that risk. So that was. Australia doesn't need another small publisher, that's for sure. There's plenty of them, and I've worked for the Small Press Network, and there's plenty of great small publishers out there. It doesn't need one who's doing the same as what the medium and big publishers are doing. But for us, it was like, oh, well, actually, maybe there is a role here for us to play, a small role, becoming part of that ecosystem, becoming maybe a rung for some writers to then jump up and make a career.
There's some tricky sort of paradoxes in that. I mean, you talk about, you know, writers making a career and you talk about doing things that don't have that commercial imperative. And I don't know how those two things collide. And yet there are all sorts of publishers that do have the commercial success who are kind of repeating the success formula over and over and over again and duplicating that with book after book. Is that, Jane, a thing? Writing, which is interesting but not commercial, what do we do with that? And what do we do with publishers who are only interested in the commercial?
Well, I was full-time freelancing before I got the Digitalise Festival job, mostly in arts journalism, but a whole bunch of other things. And I am so glad to not be full-time freelancing anymore.
Way to make a living.
Yeah, it's not. It's really tough, and it's different. You know, it's really different than a lot of the work that Sam's talking about, which is experimental fiction and experimental nonfiction. Although I do a little bit of that with criticism, like different projects, which. Although interesting, like I often sort of would, I was getting somewhere where I was getting paid more for these like esoteric experimental criticism pieces. I did a collaborative project with four critics around the world where we emailed each other for 5 days about work. And we got arts funding for that, so we actually could pay ourselves, whereas when you're sort of working in commercial spaces, you're often not... I was excluded from applying for arts funding for a lot of things because I was considered a journalist and not an artist, which...
Even artists are excluded from applying for arts funding.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. But
we've expanded
just
that idea.
But yeah, I was going forward and getting more publications and working with new editors, and I got to that ceiling where I was just like, I can't see where I go from here in Australia, and I can't see where it gets to a point where it gets easier. I just kind of reached a plateau and I had to call it quits, and I think that's I didn't call it quits, I'm still freelancing, but I have one day a week, which is my dedicated freelance day, and it's great, and I love it, but I think that's a really, really common experience for young writers.
Isn't that a more realistic experience, though, too? I mean...
Yeah, exactly, but I think it's realistic, but also, I mean, just, you know, be on my own thing, like, I think theatre criticism is a really bad place in Australia right now, and that's partly because no one can sustain a career in it, and so there's no regular voices and no big conversation. And so it's to be expected that we can't have a career in it, but I still think it's sad for Australia that writers, whether it's theatre criticism or anything, that there's not enough room to sort of really develop a voice and a collaborative conversation.
Is that, Steph, what publishing should be about? Is it about providing writer careers?
Well, I mean, I guess idealistically it would be. I think I used to work in street press, so I guess it's called Beat Magazine here. It was called The Brag in Sydney, and I used to feel like our role was to give a platform for emerging young writers to write. That was partly because they weren't getting paid. I think it's really different when you're coming at it from, a much more established global publication, for instance, where it's actually your role is not about serving the writer, it's about serving your audience. So it's really tricky in Australia because it is so small. And if you're serving your audience well, you're going to be developing writers so that you've got really amazing voices. So you should ideally be balancing both of those things, but it's really tricky.
I mean, it's sort of an expectation that there is a writing career. I sort of think that's kind of weird. I mean, there's always been people who've been successful writers. There are people who've done writing in other industries, whether it be journalism or advertising or, you know, wherever else. But the idea of that, yeah, I can write and I can be published, therefore there's a career there for me, seems to be a sort of a modern...
Yeah, I think it's only a small window of history that people were actually making money for writing, right? It hasn't always been a viable industry.
No, I mean, everybody had a second job, you know. Name the successful American novelist that didn't work in Madison Avenue somewhere. I mean, it's sort of...
Mm. It depends how you define writing as well, right?
Yeah.
Because writing literally is used as this catch-all word to describe so many different industries, and you have, like, how can you compare? And this is where pay the writers and how all these movements have real problems, because you put a copywriter in the same room as a poet, in the same room as a playwright, in the same room as an essayist, the same room as a journalist, and say, you're all the same. You're all writers, and it's like they couldn't be more different in everything that they do. And so I teach writing at universities on and off, and especially in creative writing, and we're talking, obviously, the classic fiction, essay, creative essays, but also people who are doing all kinds of different work. And I've started telling people, the students, that that you're probably not going to be able to make any money doing what you want to do. And if you actually are putting that pressure on your creative work, you are going to, like, my advice is that you'll probably find yourself up against it and burnt out before you even make it to any possibility of making a career. And so we're seeing it now, and we have seen it for the last few decades, that, you know, successful writers have had a career, a part-time job. Christos Tsokos was a vet nurse for many years up until the slap. Stephen Amsterdam, you know, palliative care nurse, and he's written his latest novel about that. And we see it all the time. And I think, that's not directly answering your question, but I think no one can expect a career. If you happen to fall, if you get fortunate and you happen, your particular focus or your particular story or particular experience and you're writing it out or whatever you're writing happens to fall within into the right publication or the right publisher's hands, and then they happen to do a very good job and then happens to find readers, then all good luck to you. But it is pure circumstance and chance, I feel like, a lot of the time. And I think a writer does the best work they can do within whatever they most want to do it in, and then have a look at where they sit, and if they can make it work and make a career out of it, like, that's really excellent. But you're one of the lucky few.
And the other thing for me, sort of in that, you know, talking about leaving freelancing is now I've decided that right now, in this very moment in time, my primary career isn't writing, but if I hadn't had that time when I could be freelancing, which wasn't just writing, it was also doing various admin things and building databases and doing research assistants. Like, it was a whole bunch of different things, but because I was freelancing, I could make leaps in my writing career that I couldn't have if I had to have if I had another job that was, I guess, more stable. Like, I travelled a lot. I've travelled all around Australia writing. I went to the UK last year, and I could only make those choices because I was entirely in charge of my own career. And I think it's tricky for me to sort of look at what I would be like as a writer if I hadn't been afforded the space to primarily define myself as a writer for so long.
I was just going to say, it's like, you know, the flip side of all of the speaking real about what it's like as an industry is that someone like extremely talented is now not being one of the best arts critics, and it's really sad to see that kind of expertise go, that's all.
Yeah, and this is something that I've seen some of the writers that I thought maybe within my generation or a little bit older, a little bit younger, and, you know, start doing academia. And like, oh, I'll do this for a couple of years to get myself footing, and then 5 years later, or they start, you know, running writers' festivals, they start doing all kinds of things, and I'm worried they're not going to come back.
Yeah.
So is that a failure of publishing as a thing? Publishing, you know, writers have to succeed, publishing has to succeed. If publishing doesn't make commercial sense, then it can't offer anybody anything. I mean, to try and bring those things together seems a really tricky sort of balance.
I think it is. I mean, I think we're specifically talking about Australia as well, and this is a very different market to where it is in the US. In the US, it's not amazing, but in Australia, it's so much smaller and it's so much trickier. But I do think that the industry definitely has some part to play in pulling it back up again. Whether or not they've done anything wrong, it's really hard to say. But I think that, you know, the industry needs to keep trying different things, and you see them trying different things.
I wonder if that's true, especially with major publishers, whether they're trying different things or whether they are very captive of the last thing that was successful or of particular genres of book.
I think Australia just tries the things that America's doing well. I don't think we're really inventing much.
Is it adventurous, Sam? I mean, are Australian publishers chancing their own?
Again, not to want to sound like I'm being a smartass again, but like, publishers is this word that's used for Penguin, Random House, and then a woman or a couple who's working out of their bedroom putting out two books a year on a particular narrow subject matter. And so there are some publishers that are doing some interesting work that are interesting insofar as trying to find the next thing or the next way to do it, or finding new ways to fund and new ways to share the load with, and then the payoffs with writers and stuff. And then there were the big ones and they're so big that they are, a micro version of the bigger economy. They have workers, they have production, they have costs, and the economics of this, kind of mirror the capitalistic economics of the world we live in right now. And unfortunately, the way that works is that the cheapest way to do something is often considered the best way, and writers are often the ones who can be squeezed the most in that equation.
I wonder, Jane, your thoughts on this. I wonder too, the things that the online world does particularly well is sort of, building relationships and communities and points of contact between people and groups. And publishing is still, in all its manifestations, is about acquiring getting a manuscript and printing it and sending it out and distributing it. And it's a very old-fashioned and pyramidal structure, regardless of sort of who does it and with what sort of intent. Have we stumbled on a model yet, do you think, that makes use of the potential of digital community that lets us exploit that in some sort of concrete way to distribute that writing in whatever form?
I think in some ways, like, you look at like places like Indigenous X published on Guardian Australia, which is it's a Twitter account that is run by a different Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander person every week. Just, you know, they're not, they might be a writer, but they also might be a doctor or a sports person or an actor. And they run a partnership with The Guardian, so The Guardian publishes a Common is Free piece by that tweeter every week, and I think that's I think there are lots of examples of that on the internet of people searching out and finding new voices who weren't necessarily writers or wouldn't call themselves writers or who didn't have access to those platforms and reaching out to them. Like I started writing for the Lifted Brow online when they got a new online editor, Simon Collinson, and I did a weird experimental criticism piece on my blog, and he sent me an email and he was like, hey, do you want to think of something weird and experimental criticism that you could do for the Lifted Brow? So I think that's a really important role for publishers and editors and myself now as a festival director, is to sort of be using the online space to actively look for different voices.
That Indigenous X idea, Steph, seems to be a really intelligent use of, you know, combined sort of media, unlike the sort of things you're talking about before where, you know, just doing stuff for the sake of it. This is that actually makes sense in terms of reaching different audiences in different ways.
Mm. It's like a super win-win situation for The Guardian, you know.
What was the sort of genesis of that?
I wasn't involved then, so I started in January.
Not your idea? You can't claim credit.
I wish I could. But, you know, it's about amplifying different voices, and The Guardian is, you know, I'm lucky enough to work for an organisation that has that as a priority, so... It's literally just a very easy win for everybody.
Hmm. The lessons in the sort of the e-book plateau that we saw in particularly Australian publishing, I mean, it's fairly universal, but, the sense that would be the future of books that turned out not to be the future of books, that it turned out to be, a consistent market and one that, you know, would stay there, but the print was still a thing which you know, had its fans. What have we learned from that?
Not to invest in any fads.
Avoid fads.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the ebook market, the ebook evolution was that was, I don't know what I was going for there. Just showed you that like new technology can come along and not have to replace something, and that ebooks would take some readers of print books, would create other readers of people who weren't reading books or weren't reading in that way, and now sits side by side, but also overlaps hugely with books. And I like the, I was hoping by now we would even stop saying maybe e-books and books, because, you know, more people start saying p-books now, and have been for several years, and it just, I can't bring myself to talk on that.
What's a p-book?
Print book.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And the whole industry says, you know, p-book, e-book, and they're books, but... Yeah, I've just been I was lucky enough to go to Hamburg recently in the last month to an independent magazine publishing conference, and not only did, you know, e-books and digital publishing kind of, maybe not plateau, but didn't take over like everyone thought it would, but print culture and print publishing is in its some kind of peak at the moment. And I remember someone at the conference talking about the independent magazines are kind of like the blogs of 10 years ago. Everyone who has a basic idea that perhaps... half of them shouldn't, are making a magazine. And it's incredible the amount of magazines now that are in the world, and the economics of them, with the kind of long-tail economics of, if you can find 2,000 readers around the world and keep your costs down, you know, people are printing in Poland or printing in Eastern Europe who perhaps make the magazine in Seattle or Melbourne or somewhere else, using another country's postal system and then delivering and then finding those 2,000 people. There's a magazine called MCR1, which is... the name of the gene for red hair, and it has about 6,000 readers around the world because it's a book, and it's only in its about fourth issue now, and they're kind of maybe scraping the bottom of the barrel, but it's a whole magazine, a beautifully produced full-colour matte magazine about red hair and about people with red hair. But think about it, if you had red hair and you found a magazine and, like, maybe you'd spend $50, $100 a year subscribing to this thing. And
it's the BuzzFeed model of targeting
niches. Yeah, and there's just so many of these magazines now, and people love having a print product and a print object and it to deliver some kind of meaningful experience to them. So I think, they're working side by side, and I think ebooks are just going to always be that different experience of reading.
I wanted to raise the idea of, because it's sort of important to a lot of writing and to some publishing, the idea of potential for public support. The amount we sort of look to funding bodies, to philanthropy. I mean, is that a necessary evil? Is it a legitimate path that can supplement the work of publishers doing good work? Are we stuck with that? Is that a good thing?
I don't think we're stuck with anything at this point. I don't think anybody can say we have only one solution, but I can say from, you know, the Guardian's experience, it's a really big part of Guardian Australia's model. We've seen our colleagues in the UK and now more recently in the US and not having a really great time, and the Guardian Australia is funded by a different model and it's largely philanthropic. And recently we've launched memberships, which are, you know, people who support what we do can pay a certain amount every month. And it seems like a small amount, but it's actually making a really big difference. And that's really important to us, and it means that we get to be independent. I don't think that would work for every single publisher, particularly when we apply the idea that the word publisher can mean every kind of different thing. But it certainly works for us. And I think the big lesson to come out of that is the importance of experimentation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Is it legitimate to have an expectation on an audience that, beyond the point, the price of purchase of whatever it is that you're reading, or in the case of The Guardian, there is none, but, you know, with books and so forth, there is. Beyond that price of purchase, there should be an expectation of further support, that if you really want to support this endeavour, you should make some other sort of contribution. Is that a legitimate sort of business path?
Well, if you look at sort of, like, literary journals in Australia, most of them, in terms of submissions, prioritise submissions from subscribers over non-subscribers. And I don't think anyone says we won't publish you if you don't subscribe to us, but most people prioritise the subscriber, and I think that's this acknowledgement that if you work within this industry, you also support this industry. And, you know, we make, as a writer who writes for literary journals, I make choices on what I subscribe to, which is mostly based on what I want to read, but is also partly based on who I want to write for, and that changes year to year. When my subscription lapses, I make a call whether I'm going to subscribe to it or resubscribe or not. But that's really important part of being a writer, I think, is supporting other writers. The audience beyond that, I don't think there's necessarily a responsibility. It depends how people perceive themselves as a reader.
See, I reckon that's a greater responsibility. I mean, as an editor of a lit mag, we don't have that policy at Meanjin of just publishing subscribers, and I think that leads to an incredibly circular sort of relationship between writer and audience. And I think
that goes back to that idea also of editors actively looking outside of their circle. Yeah, there's
which
a difference.
Which is what editors should do.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a difference between the submissions and the people that are sought out. And I don't think it should be a hard and fast rule, but I do think it makes sense to say, if you want to be part of this industry, you support this industry.
Which Sam goes a bit to that other earlier point on community and sort of building those things around publications and publishing operations.
Oh, that's huge. And for us, it's been very important. It's happened organically, especially because the founder of the Lifterbrow, Ronnie Scott's a very optimistic and positive human being, but it's been important for us all the way through. We're about to turn 10 years old as an organisation and as a magazine, not to ever try and guilt trip your readers through saying, you know, we even don't even like using the word support a lot of the time, because, I don't know, I think you might get some short-term spike of subscribers or so, but I think if you start putting the onus on your readers to as if it's their fault if you're not going to make it, I think then and this is where crowdfunding stuff starts coming in, and I see crowdfunding for, and, you know, I work in literary magazines, so that's what I see most of all, and I just go, oh, when I see some of the tone of these crowdfunding campaigns, and I'm like, you're going to get your money and everyone's going to be waiting around to see whether you make it or not, and that kind of death stink is, you know, poison to any kind of good work or something you want to do. And so we're very adamant to be always trying to make something that people want, being very transparent about how it goes down and what we're doing, and saying, buy this thing because it's really great. And because this is why it's great, and this is why it's great, and this is what we're going to give you, and this is what's in the next issue, and this is what we're trying to do, and this is why we exist, and this is why we are fiercely independent, and we aren't reaching for perhaps what might be some easier money through some corporate sponsorships, or why we're not doing a certain, you know, relationship with maybe a publisher or a university that perhaps would provide some short-term salve, but this is what we're doing, and that's all we can do is lay it out in front of people. And
it works?
It works insofar as we're doing what we want to do, and we're publishing 4 issues a year and doing other things. But we're all volunteers at the Lift a Brow, from me all the way down. Got a little bit of money here and there with a lucky project grant or something, but very few and far between. But for us, it's not about the money making and the numbers and the measurements of success are not in that. They're in what do we publish? Who, you know, can we look 8-10 years ago? Who were we publishing 8-10 years ago? And we see names like Benjamin Law and Anna Crean and stuff like that. And not saying that we made those careers, but we were a small part of that. And that's important.
But it's a tricky thing. So you can, I mean, somebody, it seems in the equation, doesn't get paid, you know, whether it's the people that put the thing together, whether it's the people who write it. I mean, this is the problematic thing. If you're trying to produce and publish staff of literary quality that's exploratory, that's using new voices, it's not going to make money.
Yeah, I'll just jump in here because I just want to talk about that a little bit. That it's where everyone at the Brow, and there's almost 30 of us who volunteer across because it is volunteering, so we spread the load. Everyone's there because they want to be. No one's making them be there, and I think what we try and impart, and we see our ourselves as a place to train up editors and train up arts workers, as well as training writers how to be writers, is being just incredibly deliberate and incredibly aware of the industry you're in. And the reason I jumped in is that our next issue, which will be out in December, is themed Capital, and we are going to be publishing incredibly detailed ledgers of the amount of hours that each writer took to on the piece, the editors, the amount of hours each editor took, all of the different numbers and money that went in. And we try, like, I like to talk about this stuff anyway, and I'm never keeping that stuff a secret anyway, but we're making a deliberate move to actually make every single tiny little machination of making a magazine an economic decision that happens, trying to be out there. Just so, and again, we're trying to strike that balance. We don't want the issue to seem like some kind of guilt-inducing thing, like, look how much time we're spending, and you know, like, that's not the tone we want, but it's we want everyone to know. Like, knowledge is the most important thing, I think, so.
It's interesting, Steph. I mean, Steph, the Guardian is another example of a thing which is not a purely commercial. It's a hybrid, you know. It has the trust, it has money which supports its activity. Increasingly, this is, you know, it's so hard unless you're doing purely commercial pop work.
Yeah.
To not have some other sort of structure around you that enables.
Yeah. So before The Guardian, I was at Junkie, and we published occasionally quite brilliant pieces of journalism and analysis, but we balanced it by publishing, you know, the kind of stuff that other sites were publishing at the same time, like Jimmy Fallon did something, and here's Walid Ali's monologue, and those would get the traffic, and we sold advertising based on the traffic that those things would get, and we used that advertising money to pay for the writers, well, to pay small amounts for the writers, we didn't have much of a budget, but to pay for the writers to produce the other stuff. So that's another hybrid that I think worked for Junkie and continues to work for Junkie quite well.
I mean, that's another one of those interesting paradoxes, I guess, that people want to come to a site like that because, yeah, the click stuff, but implied in that is a want to read the other things as well.
Yeah.
The things that aren't commercial.
There's a big metric now, which is, I can't remember what it's called, page per view, I think, which means it's a metric where you're measuring not just the people who are coming to your site, but how many articles they're clicking on when they get there and how long they're spending on your site outside of that one article. So, you know, a lot of work goes into designing a site that it's really easy for the viewer. You might see the related links at the bottom or something, a side panel that says, if you're interested in this, you might like this. Or at The Guardian, we have embedded links in every article that are relevant to your interests. And we know that because you're reading that article. And so that's another way to get people
spooky.
To...
Spooky.
Well, you know, it's a keyword. It's like if you're interested in Walid Ali, you might like this profile we prepared earlier. but there's heaps of different ways to do it, and I think that kind of information and learning from what your readers are doing is really important, whether you want to use that to sell to advertisers or use it to understand your market in such a way that you can then call for membership depends on the different model.
It does seem, Jane, that saying that people still want, you know, quality written content. There's a probably an insufficient demand for it, but
I think people definitely want good content. Like and that's, you know, that's the internet is, you know, it's filled with everything. But hopefully the good stuff is supported. One of the ways that I've started listening to, I've started engaging with like Guardian's longer essays is they've got the UK office has a podcast which is called The Guardian Long Read, and it's just one person reading out the long essays, and it takes about half an hour to read it, and that's the way I've started engaging with a lot of these essays. And then if I like it and I'm really engaged with it, then I'll go online and I'll find the link, and then I'll link out to the article and I'll link to the podcast. It's an interesting way that the internet has allowed like this good content to exist in multiple forms. And so if I'm not necessarily going to be able to sit down for half an hour, I'm still engaging with written stuff. And it's written for the page. They're not making a podcast. They're not getting the recordings and using voices. Just one person reading. It's really, really simple. But it's entirely about that. The reason it works as a podcast is because the writing is good and engaging.
Adapt to survive part of this question that we're sort of wrestling around with loosely, the survive part, I mean, I wonder what that's dependent upon, what that means. What does success look like in a modern publishing venture?
I think that depends entirely on the type of publishing venture.
Yeah. That survives, one of those words that, again, like I think is death knell. Like you're, if you're surviving, then that's not a very high bar. I think, thriving, maybe. Again, success is totally dependent on what this model is.
There are many ways in which to thrive.
Yeah. To talk about me again, since I've started working in an office with colleagues with a wage, I am healthier than I was when I was freelancing. Like my mental health is better and my physical health is better. And I just feel happier and more at ease in the world, and I'm surviving because I have a regularity of income and also a regularity of contact with other people who are sort of working on the same thing as me and working towards the same goal. And I work with a lot of editors, and I have really amazing relationships with a lot of my editors, but it's tough when you're not in the same room as them sometimes. And so for me, I realize that surviving involves working in an office and having a wage, and that's how I am going to. I feel like my writing, that the small amount of writing that I am doing as a freelancer now, is better because I'm healthier while I'm writing it.
I suspect that the survive things means, yes, different things to different publishers and so forth. Pretty different things to publishers as against writers as well. It's a strange business in that it has so many sort of hard to reconcile objectives.
Well, you talked a little bit about people getting caught up in fads and new media and new technologies, and so I think what is important is to have that key mission statement or whatever, right? Where it's like, we exist for this, and we can use whatever tools and whatever new ways of funding this, and we can experiment, but we've got to be doing this. If we're not doing this quickie thing, then that's perhaps, it doesn't matter if we get twice as many or 10 times as many clicks, because suddenly, wait a second, that's not what we wanted to do. And so the lifted brow, we're about considered, takes on topics that perhaps are esoteric or different ways of looking at things, or, fiction or poetry from voices that don't get perhaps the megaphone as much, and we'll use things use Instagram as a way to deliver a story, or Facebook people using social media as the place for publication, not the place to promote and link towards, or we'll find ways to do things. We'll do, instead of commissioning a piece for a paper, we'll actually commission it for a live event, and that is a new thing that people are doing with events and face-to-face time being something that people are craving. But it's always about coming back to we're still doing what we wanted to do, it's just using these different, adapting in ways to reach the maximum amount of people for that particular writer
That's sort of turning publishing into a creative community of its own right, isn't it?
Which is what has happened, right? Like, I think, again, within the literary journal world, literary magazine world, some took a while to come around and others were early adopters to this approach that your community and that you were maybe no longer just a magazine, you were a publishing organisation, and perhaps you did events now, and perhaps you do workshops, and perhaps you are a manuscript assessment service, and you know, using these skills, as long as you are able to keep doing that core thing again. So,
and also with survival, it's not. I think it's when we're thinking about it in this context, it's perhaps more about thinking about an industry surviving rather than individual publications or individual people. I'm really loving working on the Digital Rise, so I'm really excited about it. I hope I get to do it again, but it's not a model that needs to survive forever because the internet is going to change, and so then the festival is going to have to adapt or leave, and that'll be fine, and there'll be something else that steps into its place. And it's the same, we'll lose literary journals and we'll lose magazines. The thing that we have to be working towards is ensuring that we still have spaces for writers and we still have reporters and news and spaces to gather, whether that's online or in physical spaces. But I don't think, even though I would like to continue working in this field as a writer or as a director or as something else in the publishing writing world, my survival isn't as important in those spaces as the survival of the whole piece. And I am just, what I want to be doing is just contributing to all of it, working together and moving into the future.
It's your turn now. You can ask questions and there will be answers to them. This is the way we've structured this. There are people roving about with microphones. If you stick your hands in the air, they will see you and they will come and attend to you. First question, because we can't see you, you're completely oblivious to us.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested in what, in your experience, is the best way to have sustained and meaningful, a sustained and meaningful relationship with your readership online. I'm coming at it from the perspective of trying to create online content to support a print magazine. So obviously our print magazine is our core thing. But then you have online content that is, in one sense, it's marketing. It's marketing for the magazine. But then it's also content in its own right. And, I'm curious about how you guys see the best way to engage with an audience that's meaningful, that lasts longer than, you know, a few seconds, do I have an unrealistic dream? Is it the nature of the medium that I can only attempt to entice someone for a very short period of time?
Speaking from the literature browse point of view, so same as you, like the print magazine is the core of the organisation, and that's a tricky thing, and we're currently, and we have been for a while now, discussing and building a new site and discussing what that means. And you know, you want to funnel people towards the magazine, but we also publish work online that's online only. And so for us it was a decision as to what works in print, what doesn't, and to make sure that we weren't publishing so much online that people got their lifted brow fix, but also recognising that there are some people who are only ever going to engage with the work online and some will only ever engage with the print. So for online, we figured out after, you know, it took year on year to slowly shaping it, but that we do two categories of work, which is what we call commentary, which is stuff that is some kind of social or political commentary, which, you know, will attract attention in some way, whether it's something about something that happened today, although more regularly, like, that's not our space, that's the space of places like The Guardian. We look at commentary about stuff that's in the zeitgeist but perhaps didn't break today, and then book reviews and literary criticism, because again, book reviews are things that people share a lot and they work better online. But we were one of those organisations that when apps started really taking off, we managed to start working with a mobile magazine app developer, and we got so excited. We had this opportunity, and we created another whole magazine and an app, and because we were thinking along the same lines that there were things that will only work in an app, and we'll do app-specific commissioning, and it'll be really great. We had another whole group of editors doing it, and it was just so much resources into something that was actually cannibalising what else we were doing. And we very quickly knocked that on the head, because we didn't have the resources of doing what we were doing already, let alone another whole magazine. So, like, to come back to your question, I would say that you'd want to have, you know, content, which is not a word that I like using all the time, but work that establishes you as a brand or as an identity that perhaps then, you know, on the site, people are pointed towards the print magazine in some way. But that's, you know, that's a very vague answer, because it's different for every single publication and every different masthead, I suppose. Mm.
I wonder if... sorry, I don't want to hog the conversation. But I wonder if ownership is part of it. It's a word that you mentioned earlier, Sam. I mean, as part of the ritual for print, if only the reader can have some sense of, I guess, ownership, or if it's a question of maybe them contributing to the narrative in some way, whether it's through comments or whether it's through creating some kind of, space, a space for gathering as well.
I would say that that's like a really, if you've got a really solid community of readers who are vocal and really interested in what you're doing, then there's nothing better than to give them a space to talk about it. And I think in the Guardian's network, you know, say what you want to about the Guardian comments, the Guardian commenters are really into it. and you know, similarly, I mean, Gawker.com has now gone under, but the Gawker Media Group prided themselves on the kind of their comments and the way their comments were worked and how many people came there for the comments, and that can really, really impact the feel of a site as well. So Jezebel, which is part of that group, had this extremely lovely community of commenters before that really existed in many other places, and I think it can be a really, really good tool.
Is there a classy way to do native content? You guys got any ideas? Like, so you don't feel like you like kind of just trick people?
I think so. Junkie Media Group did a lot of sort of championing of native content. You know, like 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago now. And I think, you know, I was part of those conversations right at the beginning, and I think the classiest thing you can do is be as honest as possible about it, right? Like, I think it's not native content if you're tricking your readers. The whole point of it should be a seamlessly integrated thing that you're happy with as an editor. And if a brand is happy, great. If they're going to pay for it, even better. But it shouldn't be advertorial, which means that you're not really mentioning the brand throughout, right? So you have to mention them at the top, and you have to mention them at the bottom, and you have to make it clear to the reader that the brand is part of this. It's a really, really tricky space, and I think...
That's not how it works, though, is it?
Well, it's not how it always works, and that's why it gets so tricky. And I think as we kind of continue developing it, the Guardian deals with it really differently, but... there was a lot of really tense conversations we had at Junkie Media trying to work out what our policy was around native, and we tried a lot of different things. We did some beautiful long form that was paid for, and it paid our writers better than we could pay them from our editorial budget, but sponsored by a brand, and we'd get a really amazing writer to write a really amazing piece, but it was brought to you by a brand. And it wasn't a brand that was mentioned throughout the article, but it was that this brand has made this piece of work viable. And I think that is kind of the dream of an editor, because it means that a brand can pay someone you want to commission, but you can't afford to commission them. So I think that's the classiest way of all, but I don't think it works for everyone.
Sam, would you ever integrate?
Would I ever
find a brand?
No, it's not for us. But like, again, what's a brand? Like, there are brands that we would work with. Like, we have an office at RMIT, and RMIT, you know, every university now is a huge brand. So we already, you know, we're partnering up with RMIT just because they let us use a space, and we give them... We work within a couple of their programs and things like this. So when I say no, I mean maybe. But, but it would be like Steph said, like if it's in any way obfuscated, then that's gross, and that's kind of like that's actually lying, and that's, I find that really gross. If it's clearly demarcated, that's excellent, and then the reader has the opportunity to keep going, to complain, to do whatever they want to do, but if it's in any way hidden, then that for me is a huge problem, because that then is borrowing from the editorial, whatever editorial reputation that that masthead, that website, that editor has built up, or that group of editors are, is now being used by somebody who has no interest in the, anything except making money for their brand. And that's they're two different things that should be, if they come together, it has to be incredibly forthright, I think.
But yeah, and I think it can come together, and I think there's nothing wrong with making money, and there's nothing wrong with saying yes to a brand who whose vision aligns with yours and who wants to give you more money to do what you think you're already doing and what you want to do. But I think, you know, you want to hold that integrity that Sam was talking about earlier. You need to keep an eye on what you're doing as a publication and make sure that the brand isn't getting in the way of that. Otherwise, it starts becoming a bit gross. Yeah. Unless all you want to do is make money, which is totally fine as well.
And there are many different types of native content. Yeah. There is the brow could do it because we would say, this is exactly what we're going to do, and then approach brands and say, do you want to help fund this? And if they said yes, then that's excellent, because they haven't had any say. Where there are other brands who come along to a site and say, hey, wear this, we'll give you this much money, but we want this covered in this way. Mm. And then there is, you know, everywhere in between. So like, I was lucky enough when Steph was editor at Junkie to do a piece of, like, my first and only experience of native content writing, and that's not because of that experience.
It's terrible.
But it was a Contiki paid piece, and I got to interview kind of five young, stupid Australians who were living in a bus in Canada, and I interviewed them on Skype and wrote about 3,000 words or something for Steph, and instead of being paid, I think the going rate for Junkie at that time was anywhere between $75 to $150. Mm. I got $2,500 to write this one piece.
And for us, it was like, well, we get to have Sam Cooney on our site writing what was to us, you know, a long-formish piece, and it was a beautifully written piece. It was exactly the kind of piece I wanted to publish. The brand hadn't pre-approve it? I can't remember.
I wasn't involved in that.
But the brand certainly didn't say, this is the idea, get a writer on it. It was about the writer pitching us, and then we'd pitch the brand, and the brand would say, yes, okay, that one's good. And that was...
Yeah, it was all about board. I was from the get-go allowed, you know, to say yes or no to this thing, and also the whole way through it was like Contiki logo, like it wasn't in any way, and it was on a different, whole different actual sub page and everything. So, you know, that was, and I did that for the money. Mm. Like, I didn't set out that day to be like, I really feel like writing about these five people in a bus in Canada for Contiki, but that was excellent. And that $2,500 or whatever it was, helped me do Lift a Brow probably for the next 2 months, you know. So,
and we all, like, writers all make decisions about money. Like, I write stuff for the money. Like, that's not narrative, native digital. It's just like, well, I mean, less so now, but when I was freelancing, like, yeah, I mean, I didn't really care about this piece, but I needed the money that week, and so you make those decisions. That's part of being a writer and working in this world.
But in a lot of ways, it's more honest. I mean, you mentioned travel. I mean, respectable newspapers for decades have been sending people off on freebies, which of course, you know, allows them, you know, at arm's length to pay the writer with no declaration of that interest. And you know, there's that whole subculture of gift and freebie, which at least this brings to the surface to some extent. Another hand? Probably got time for one more.
Hi. Interesting with the theme of survival, Sam. Congratulations on 10 years of Lift a Brow.
Oh, yeah. It's not just me. Trust me, there's a huge team. But thank you. Yeah,
I know. I was just wondering, does that success and that maturity make it harder to do what you do or easier? Is there freedom in success? And is there any tension between bringing along your current readers and attracting a new audience?
That's a lot there. Reaching 10 years, like Lift a Brow has kind of always prided itself on a little bit of irreverence and maybe being a bit of a needle in the side of institutions or organisations or established whatevers. And yet now we're sort of like, we're doing a pretty good job of putting a magazine out every 4 months, and now we're publishing books and we have a pretty excellent website, and it's something like, wait a second, we're kind of pretty established here, which has led to some really interesting conversations about what can we do, like, to maybe take us off whatever rut we might be in, not a rut, but whatever safe track we're on. Are there things, are there responsibilities we actually have to be doing that? And what do we do, and how can we pass on, you know, whatever knowledge or whatever success we have to others and to next, you know, next generations of publications or makers of broadcasters and publishers. And I think the other part of your question was, how do we keep readers? And that's just I don't know. I think if you start thinking that sort of stuff, you're going to do your own head in. We have editors who change, and they bring their own, like, they bring their own take, their own preferences, and, you know, of course you'll lose some people. And the last couple of editors who've just stepped aside were very interested in a couple, you know, in identity politics and social politics, and then also technology. And the next couple of editors who've just stepped in are interested in mostly, like, a lot film and poetry. And so I'm sure the magazine's going to take a little bit of that direction, and that's excellent. That's change, and the last thing we want to be doing is not changing. So I don't know if that just is me talking around the point and not really answering, but yeah, we don't also have the time to sit around and, as volunteers with other jobs, sit around just thinking these things through and talking them over day after day. They happen kind of organically, and then we look back and it feels like a smart decision that we didn't make, but we'll own. Yeah. I don't know if these guys want to jump on that stuff, but no?
Yeah. Our time anyway is up. Thank you for your rapt attention. If you thank, please, Sam Kearney and Jane Howard and Steph Harmon. Your work here is done.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.